behind the attacks, saying it was a response to U.S. drone strikes. Reading for Gabe Matthews in Peshawar, Pakistan, I'm Shauna Ray, Free Speech Radio News.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. correspondent, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Janine Etter and Shauna Ray. Our theme music was composed and produced by Alan Weatherhead. Thanks for listening in Los Angeles. I'm Dorian Marina.
Every Tuesday night from 10 p.m. to midnight, KBOO brings you The Anjali and the Kid Show with DJ Anjali and the Incredible Kid. Post-national bass, folk, and urban sounds that'll knock you upside the head.
It's Anjali and the Kid every Tuesday night on KBOO.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or RadioCab.net.
The time is 6:01. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Tune In, Turn On, and Remember.
The whole place with something great happened.
For 45 years, KBOO has let the sun shine in across Cascadia's airwaves. Join us every month in this, our 45th year, as we tell another story from the history of KBOO.
On Tune In, Turn On, and Remember, we hear the voices of some of the early volunteers and staff with KBOO Community Radio, which began in 1968 in the city of Portland as a listener-supported, community-based station. This year, we're celebrating our 45th anniversary, and we are still listener-supported. You can be a part of this amazing community by going to kboo.fm, which is back online, and click on Donate Today in the top right corner. Tonight, we hear a special program recorded in 1993 as part of KBOO's 25th anniversary special, hosted by Kathleen Stevenson. We begin with Walt Curtis, a longtime volunteer with KBOO who still hosts a poetry program on KBOO on Monday nights. In this segment, he's speaking with the late Roger Ferguson, who was one of KBOO's first station managers.
I became station manager in December of 1970. We got a Crosby, Stills, and Nash record in the mail. And Calhoun took the thing and he just broke it.
He was a classical freak, wasn't he? Classical music was his thing.
Well, he was his ideal for KBOO was that there would be no electronically amplified music on it at all.
Acoustic.
So, I mean, you could play Joan Baez, and you could play, the John Coltrane, and those people who weren't electrified then. But I mean, Crosby, Stills, Nash, he just broke it. I never got a chance to listen to it. I mean, I went to the board and I said, Calhoun's getting really intolerable. He breaks Crosby, Stills, and Nash records.
And good idea, actually, but no way. No. I'm Walt Curtis, local poet, and I co-host The Talking Earth with Barbara Lamorticella, and we work really well together, I believe. I do a program then twice monthly. The reason why I demanded that Roger Ferguson be here, I call him the boss. He's the person who somehow got a shy wallflower type like myself to get in front of a microphone and extemporize and orate in front of a microphone. And I thank you, Roger. I thank you very much. And I think when I came in, what year was it, Roger? I know I have problems. Was it 1970? Does anyone know? I'm not sure.
It's either 70 or 71.
Yeah.
If I was station manager when you came aboard, it was 71.
Okay.
If Calhoun was still around, it was 70.
Well, you know what I remember is that I felt so reluctant to do it, and I guess you'd probably heard me performing in public, and I still do that, you know, at cafes, and there were anti-war readings in those days. But you actually, as good community radio should do, you brought somebody in off the street, and you brought somebody in, and you said, you can do this. And I felt really shy about it, and I don't really feel that shy anymore about being in front of a microphone after 22 or 3 years or whatever it's been. But at that time, in fact, I ignore the microphone. It doesn't even interest me. In fact, the volume levels show that occasionally, but I thank you for that. But the thing is, by you bringing me in, I came up with the idea, a concept of bringing all the poets, all the writers, the literary types that I would meet in the community. And so down through the years then, I have tried not to overpump my own ego or my own personality, though of course it probably pops in occasionally. But in the early years, I did 4 programs a week. I mean, a month. I had 4 guests on a month, and it really got to be tough.
I think it was 1969, although it might have been 1970, in August. The American Legion had its national convention in Portland, Oregon. Richard Nixon was the invited guest speaker.
Oh, my God.
And there was a great deal of commotion regarding this event, because there was a significant, if not very well organized, anti-war movement in Portland as well as nationally. And there was an ad hoc organization that sprung up called the People's Army Jamboree, which was an effort to protest the presence of Richard Nixon and the American Legion in Portland, Oregon. And there were, among other things, threats to throw LSD in the Portland water supply, something that never, unfortunately, occurred.
right.
But Tom McCall, our dearly beloved governor,
supposedly liberal,
called out the National Guard. Well, yeah. I mean, he could have been radical. He still, you know, he didn't want his government to break down. And he called up the National Guard, and he also organized a rock festival called Vortex.
That's right.
Which was held out by Estacada.
To draw the hippies.
To draw off all the hippies to Estacada.
Hippie politicos.
Where they could all run around naked and smoke dope and have whatever kind of fun they wanted.
A mini Woodstock McIver Park.
Yes. I never went out there. Although a friend of mine was on the fire crew out there. But he missed all the good stuff in town, which included um, me drive. I distinctly recall driving downtown one night past the police headquarters, which was at 2nd and Pine. And there were National Guardsmen stationed at the corners of the police headquarters with their M16s and helmets and all that stuff. And it just shook me. I mean, like, God, this is what it's like in Eastern Europe. I mean, this is the end.
You're listening to the voices of some of the early volunteers and staff with KABU Community Radio. Coming up next is the first volunteer coordinator, Sue Sargent, speaking in 1993.
Let's see, I was a volunteer in 72, 73, and started work on staff in 73. I remember because it was April 1st, a good day to start a new job on April Fool's Day. 72, 73 through 76, probably. About the time that KABU moved downtown. And then I wandered off and did other things for a while and came back in 78, 79, 80 as a volunteer. And I remember coming in for some of the pledge drives and things like that, you know, answering phones and maybe a collating party for the program guide. That was always my thing, was collating parties. I was between jobs, as our I suspect most KABU volunteers at one time or another. If it weren't for unemployment, KABU wouldn't exist. But I had, I was between jobs, kind of at loose ends, wanted to know what to do with myself. And I'd been listening to the Sunday morning music, you know, just for ever so long, and had talked with the announcer on the air, called up, and he had mentioned that KABU needed volunteers. Well, I called up and said, okay, what can I do? KABU was an insane little storefront on 31st and Southeast Belmont. I think it was two large rooms and a bathroom. And that was about it. If you had to interview someone, you just hope no one flushed the toilet or hope no, you know, the phones didn't ring out in the office. And we had a itty-bitty control room that was soundproofed with, I think, egg cartons on the wall. It was that kind of a place. And we had between 200 and 400 volunteers at that point. During, you know, that time, there were as many as 200 people coming in the door every week, or at least during a month's time. So it was really important to make sure that they didn't all show up at the same time, or you just wouldn't have anywhere to put them. So John Ross used to tease me and say, well, you're the social director. But sometimes it was important to have, like, a potluck dinner to get people together so they'd have a chance to talk, because they'd never see each other at the station. Sometimes potluck dinner was a good way to get people together to do the collating and the stapling. And we had some pretty competitive potluck dinners.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes. Well, people would get just carried away with what kind of dishes they'd bring in. And one fellow brought in stuffed grape leaves, you know, very Greek. I think at one point I realized I had gotten carried away when I brought in, would you believe, pickled trout in aspic to a KABU potluck? Good grief.
What was the mood like, or the general atmosphere like, of KABU during those years? How would you describe it?
I suspect we were all crazy hippies, or we thought we were. Some of us were a little straighter than others. There are some wonderful stories floating around KABU. My favorite, or one of my favorites, is the FBI guy. Apparently someone had heard something on late night that they thought was just, you know, outrageous and shouldn't be on the air. So instead of calling the FCC and complaining, they called the FBI. You know, maybe they couldn't read the listing in the phone book quite right. So the FBI, straight-laced, you know, hard-working people that they are, investigated KABU. I suspect, and this is all conjecture, they must have hired, you know, had one of their people spending full time listening to KBOO. But they were, you know, they had received a complaint about obscenity on the air, and they were going to follow through with it. So one day, we had a knock on the door, and this man came to the door, and, you know, straight lace suit, black shoes, the whole thing. And here are all these crazy volunteers and staff people running around. And one of the volunteers looked at him and goes, oh, my God, it's the fuzz. Well, the poor man, you know, is trying to do his job. At that point, he's just thoroughly humiliated. And he asked for the station manager, who at that time was Dick Triffenwalder, who I think was a Methodist minister, something, you know, something fairly straight but still sort of hippie-ish. A good connection. So Dick is trying to handle this man in a polite, responsible manner. Everybody else is standing over in the corner giggling. You know. So the guy tries to be very discreet and flipped open his badge, right? He's supposed to show his identification. And he looks around, he says, is there some place we can speak in private? You know, that was a joke, because the only place you could have any privacy was in the bathroom. Not a good place to interview someone. So about that time, I had to go to probably the paper supply store or something, you know, picking up office supplies. So when I came back, I asked the station manager, I said, well, what happened? And Dick says, well, didn't you know? I'd been arrested. I go, what? And he starts laughing. He was teasing me. But he said that the fellow had said that his investigation was complete and that no KBOO did not play obscene things on the air. And then, for some reason, or this appeared in the newspaper, you know, that KBOO had been under investigation for obscenity. And shortly thereafter, we got a call from the head of the FBI in Portland saying, wait a minute, we were never investigating you. What is this? So I don't know if the guy that came to the door was really FBI, or, as is more likely, he was FBI, but the local office didn't know anything about him. Who knows? But KBOO was never charged with anything. And I don't know, should it really have gone to the FBI instead of the FCC in the first place? But it's a good story. At one point, we were changing out transmitters. And Pooh and mostly Gray and Scott were working on trying to refit this new transmitter, get it up and running, and there was some part that they absolutely had to have to hook up one pipe to two pipes. I guess it's called a Y connection because it looks like a Y. Okay, so Gray asked me if I would take him shopping at, you know, Newberry's or someplace. We ended up in the women's lingerie department because he's trying to find like a girdle or something that's stretchy that you could hook up to one part and then have come out at two parts, like a Y. Well, we discovered, you know, here's Gray holding up these panty girdles and things, looking at them and trying to stretch them. He says, no, that's too stretchy. This just won't work. Because, of course, the air, which is what you're trying to move, would just blow out the panty girdle. So so here's these guys with me in the, the women's department at a store. By the way, we ended up using a pair of my cut-off jeans instead. And I don't know, my jeans may still be in there for all I know. But at some point, I saw, you know, after they had it up and running, with air billowing out my cut-offs, it looked like there was a human butt in the transmitter someplace. When I first started there, again, this was 70, maybe 73, maybe late 72, but apparently, again, this was at the Belmont site with the small quarters and the itty-bitty space. Dave Calhoun was the station manager at that time, and Calhoun had left by the time I got there. I had been hearing snatches of conversation. It was back in probably 73, early 73. But I'd hear people say things like, hey, remember when Dave nailed Pooh in the bathroom? Har, har, har. And that's all I'd hear. They obviously knew the story. They were just reminding each other and laughing about it. And of course, when one hears about nailing someone, I mean, there's all sorts of possibilities. And only later did Pooh tell me the real story. Apparently in this, you know, in the Belmont site, which was really small, really crowded, Dave Calhoun, who was station manager at the time, had just been annoyed beyond his ability to handle it. And he and Pooh must have gotten into a really bad argument, and he started chasing Pooh around the building. Well, Pooh, thinking that the only place to get away from this madman was in the bathroom, goes in there, shuts the door. And there's this bang, 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 bang on the door, and he figures, well, Calhoun's just pounding on the door, being frustrated. So he thought he'd wait while it quieted down, and he was hoping that Calhoun had gone away. And then Pooh tries to open the door. Calhoun had nailed it shut and put up a sign that said, do not feed the Pooh. So at some point, Pooh managed to get somebody's attention and tell them to get a crowbar and get him out. Because in those days, there was only one itty-bitty window in the bathroom, and he couldn't have gotten out any other way, but he was nailed in the bathroom. They did leave up the Do Not Feed the Pooh sign. Well, that bathroom also had great graffiti. I think that's the first place I saw the A Woman Needs a Man Like a Fish Needs a Bicycle. That was the first time I saw that one. But there used to be a running series of philosopher jokes. And sometimes you'd spend a lot of time in the bathroom just reading the walls. Somebody else would come and pound on the door and tell you it was needed and get out.
Now you, I believe, maintain that you're probably the only person, and I didn't bring the picture, but you're probably the only person that can identify everybody in a famous picture from in front of that Belmont site of KABOO, which includes a lot of some of the people you've been talking about and then some other people. Do you know how that picture got taken?
Yeah, I was holding up traffic so they could take the picture without getting the photographer run over. The idea was to make a special picture for the program guide cover for a month that we were having a pledge drive. And so we wanted something really special. And so Dick Treffenwalder, who is the station manager, is out there supposedly directing an orchestra. Well, it's made up of Michael Creditor in full Bulgarian costume playing a balalaika.
And who was Michael Creditor?
Okay, Michael Creditor, I believe, started world music-type programming at KABOO. Michael and or Misha. I think he goes by Misha Creditor now. But he was there playing the balalaika. And Tim Swain, who is a local early music person, was wearing Renaissance garb, holding up his lute and frowning because it was starting to rain. And, of course, Pooh Rogers was hanging off the side of the building. Not playing an instrument, just hanging out. Literally hanging there. And we had, let's see, Barry Schwalm was there playing spoons. He was an early, what would we call him? A poet and unusual music type person. I'm not quite sure how to how to classify him. Let's see, Elizabeth, whose last name I can't remember at the moment, was playing something else. She was a volunteer, and I'm not sure if she was on staff, but she was maybe 5 feet tall. And Barry Schwann was probably 6'4", 6'5", so it was a good contrast there. Let's see, we had Art Cansaw, a fellow who used to play at Saturday Market, probably until the day he passed away, but he was playing musical saw. We had Scott, whose last name eludes me, marvelous mustache though, and full Western regalia playing guitar, and he alternated with Wade, whose last name I don't remember. This is embarrassing. A lot of people. But Scott and Wade alternated late night, I think, good grief, Wednesdays with a country western program, and this was early country western. This wasn't the modern schlock. This was the good old stuff. So Scott was there holding up country western. Or Mildred Schwab, there we go. Barry Schwab, Mildred Schwab, okay. She represented the fact that Portland City Council was on KABOO twice a week. She was a city council member, and she was playing keyboards. Good grief. I'm trying to think of this photograph, right? But we had just a lot of people there. And there's one little boy in a warm-up suit and a baseball cap playing a toy piano. And the reason I can say that I'm the only one that knows those people is that that little kid was my nephew, who is now, I think, living in Texas and over 20. And, you know, that was a long time ago. Yeah. But he was just a little kid.
So you remember when George came to the station, or was he here, was he there before you got there?
George must have always been there. I remember his being there for the Saturday program, and then he came on staff at one point. I think he was, if not public affairs, yeah, he was public affairs director for a while, and gave me some wonderful training. It was great. He would have like this checkoff list, And when I was supposed to go interview someone, he'd make sure, you know, have you got that Y connector? Have you got two microphones? And he'd make sure, he'd go over all these things he was cramming into this bag. Have you got enough tape? You know, and he taught me a wonderful thing about interviewing people, which is when, and I see you're doing it, when you're interviewing someone on the radio, you need to give lots of eye contact, but you can't be sitting there going, and agreeing with everything that the person says, because that comes across sounding just horrible on the radio. So you smile and nod a lot, and George taught me that. And Karen Burdick and her goats, that was, Karen Burdick was our program director for a while, and she had at least one goat that I know of who would ride around in her car. And sometimes, let's see, I guess Karen and I went to a concert one time, and I remember the car did smell a bit goaty. But that's okay. It was fun. I left just about the time that Cabo was moving downtown. I'm not quite sure if I had a mental breakdown, but it was driving me crazy. It was as close to being totally crazy as I've ever come. And I was just stressed out because, as many nonprofit organizations will, if you say, sure, I'll work 60 hours a week, sure, I'll work 80 hours a week, the organization needs the work done, and they're perfectly happy to let you just work your tail off. And at the point where I realized I have no personal life, I absolutely despise what I'm doing to myself and everybody else, I said, okay, I'm going to leave in 8 weeks. You know, find somebody to replace me. Give me a chance to train this person. So much of this is in my head that, you know, I've got to give it to somebody else. And it took him 3 weeks after I had left to hire somebody. So that's probably typical.
That was Sue Sargent, a volunteer at KABU and staff person in the early 1970s.
Well, this is Michael O'Rourke. I've been a listener to KABU since almost the very beginning. I think I may have started listening to KABU in 1968 or 69. One of the first programs I heard was the that I tuned into regularly was the Bluegrass Show, which at that time was done by Jim Seifelt. And I a couple of years later had an opportunity to do the Bluegrass Show myself. And that's how I actually got started with KABU a little before that time as a air shift engineer in 1971, I think it was, and recorded a few live concerts, and then I shortly after that time became the weekly host of the Bluegrass Show, which I named Music from the True Vine a couple years after that, and that name has stuck to the present day. And in, 1977, I guess, I won the honor of serving on KABU's board of directors. Actually, I was appointed briefly, and then I ran in a board election and served on the board for a total of 5 years. Stopped doing the Bluegrass Show in the early, well, I stopped doing it weekly in 1979 and stopped doing it in altogether in the early 1980s. And since that time, I've been a freelance producer for KABU and also for national distribution. So that's in a nutshell my story.
Carol Mazur, what's your story? Carol?
My nutshell's a little smaller. I came to KABU originally because I was hired to do publicity and development. And about 6 months later, we changed some roles and I became the program director.
What year is that, Carol?
76 is when I started, January of 76. And I left my job as program director in the fall of 77. And then from that point on, I did volunteer programming. I did a program. I did several programs. A lunch program, which was a mixture of whatever you wanted to do, which had different names over the years. Hot Lunch Special was the first one. Possibilities was what it was before I left it. And I considered Possibilities a kind of roaming show. Then in 1979. I left the country for 13 years. And so my association with KABU sort of dwindled. I would see my old friends when I came back. George Page was one of the people I always at least had a talk with on the phone over all those years. Of course, Mary and Michael.
Mary Orr?
I first heard about KABU by reading about it in the Portland Scribe. And it was around International Women's Day of 1977. And the Scribe advertised a big special on KABU, so I tuned in and got dead air. I was a bit confused until I tuned in a day or two later and found out that the transmitter had gone down. Anyway, I loved what I heard on the air, and I thought, these people are talking about real things. This is really political. This is really animated, vibrant, important. And so I tore down to the station where I was greeted warmly and immediately stuck in front of a microphone to help Tim Scott with a Paul Robeson special. So I liked it. And at that time, I learned from speaking with people such as Andy Simon and Carol Mazur and Sarah Cook that there was a major upheaval going on at the station, and two-thirds of the staff essentially was being fired. So I instantly became a volunteer, and within a couple months was working at the station as office manager and de facto volunteer coordinator. And with one of the people on the hiring committee was Michael O'Rourke.
And that's how we met, in fact.
Can I backtrack? Because you mentioned International Women's Day, and like I said, I left the area for many years, but of course I would come back. And I came back for this last period. I've been back for a year and a half now. And in March of 1992, I turned on KABU and heard that there were several days of women's programming for International Women's Day. Karen and I started that in 1976, and the way that happened was when I was hired onto the staff, Karen, who was working in a sea of mainly male staff people and mainly male volunteers, I think, I felt an ally, and she said, why don't we try doing 24 hours of women's programming? And I figured, well, you know, you learn by doing, so I said, sure, let's do it. And we got all the women together, and that's how it began. I believe that was 1976, the first year. And I see that it's burgeoned since. And I hadn't gotten my license yet to broadcast, but I was planning to do a show, and somebody was going to come in and engineer the show for me. Got there, absolutely nobody was there except the person who was on the air, who's going to have to leave. I came in, the very first program I had ever done in my life, had it all prepared on zillion pieces of paper, thinking that I would organize it. And I found that I had to organize the show, put the records on, and engineer the whole thing. And I did it, of course. An hour later, my engineer came in with a bottle of wine, which I gulped down. And I had the tape of that show from the very beginning. You could hear me talking like this. And by the end, of course, I had my radio voice and I didn't have any problem. But that was sort of my entry into live broadcasting, which turned me on.
Carol, mine was somewhat similar, except I didn't go in with an organized program. I was working as office manager on one of the two desks that serviced the whole staff and a multitude of volunteers. And a programmer simply didn't show up. And for some reason, this was over on the Belmont Street station, there was nobody else in the station. I was completely alone. I'd only done that one Paul Robeson show, and someone else was engineering it. So I just went in, completely flipped out what to do, grabbed some Dave Van Ronk records and played them all afternoon. And it was hours until George Page finally came crashing through the door ready to do a news show. And I was supposed to have turned on city council, had no idea how to do it. I had been given no training. But I did get the sound out over the airwaves.
I think
and I got fan calls. People love the Dave Rant. Who wants to listen to this? No, I shouldn't say that. Never mind. There are people who really want to listen to city council. But on that day, they were into the music.
Okay. Do you want to talk a little bit about that
time of upheaval?
It was a very difficult time. Money was in question. The whole real future of KABU was in question. And the question of preserving what was worth preserving and not getting too slick was a real central issue. And I think it wasn't just a central issue at KABU, but practically everywhere. I mean, it was part of the times.
Yeah, it was also a time of real change and growth, I think, at KABU. And it always seems that those times are the times that cause the internal dissension as well, or at least contribute to it. And KABU moved from its sort of hole-in-the-wall location on Belmont Street.
It wasn't a hole-in-the-wall. It was a cave. It was literally a cave.
Yeah, you could hear the toilets flushing over the air.
Well, it was a big step up from where I started with KABU, which was literally a hole-in-the-wall in a basement in downtown Portland. But yeah. There were a lot of stories that came out of Belmont Street. One of them was one night I came in to do the bluegrass show, and there was a volunteer that was on the air just playing a tape of a program. He was doing what they used to call in those days an engineering shift, so he was just playing tapes and giving station IDs, and then I was going on the air live with the Bluegrass Show at 9 o'clock. And I came in about 20 minutes before my show was to begin and heard this tape. The volunteer that was on the air, by the way, was someone who was in high school. I think he was a junior in high school or something, and had just recently started volunteering at KABU, and obviously didn't receive totally great training either. Mary's already mentioned the amount of training she received before she went on the air. Anyway, I came in to the control room, was getting ready to get my records ready for the Bluegrass Show, and I all of a sudden noticed the programming that was going out over the air at that time, and the tape was clearly being played backwards. And it had obviously been going that way for at least 10 or 15 minutes, because I think the show had started at 8:30 and I didn't get there until almost a quarter of 9. And I pointed it out to the volunteer, and he said that he didn't realize that it was playing backwards because he'd noticed on the box that the person that was being interviewed was from Germany, and he thought it was in German. So anyway, we fixed that problem, although it was kind of midway through the program. I don't remember how we resolved that, but
perhaps the sad thing to say is nobody called.
That's right. But what I was starting to say, though, was that if we were talking about the sort of period of dissension and disagreement about the future directions of KABU, they occurred at that time anyway. They were triggered partially by big changes at KABU, one of which was to move from Belmont Street to downtown, to the second floor location above Patty's. And there was a lot of controversy over whether that was the right move for the station.
We had a major board meeting where some bylaws were going to be changed to make it necessary for board members to be elected, because there was some kind of clause where they could be appointed. My details are vague. We could look through the files, you know. But it was very important, and the board at the time put this agenda item at the very end of the agenda, and we had our meeting in a public place, not at KABU, it was at the Ben Franklin Community Center, and at 10 o'clock the board declared that the meeting was over and that we had to be out of that building at 10 o'clock, and so we could not discuss even these bylaw changes. And so there was some bitter debate, and people had to leave. And the next day, in everybody's, all the volunteers and staff mailboxes, were copies of the agreement between KABU and Ben Franklin stating that that room was open until midnight. So, and it was Norman Solomon who put those leaflets, put the copy of the contract into the mail slots. We also had a very unfortunate situation where the station manager at the time kind of teamed up with the owner of the building that we were in, that Michael was just describing, to evict us.
We were doing the work because we really believed in it, and you know, we just felt so attacked and felt like everything that we were working for was just really being pulled right out from under us. And the question as to a real analytical approach to what KABU had to do and how it had to grow was not really allowed the kind of dialogue that was necessary, because it became so polarized. It was either big time, or I don't even remember how it was characterized in those days, but I would imagine, you know, sort of low-beat hippie was
alternative, right?
You know.
And the other thing, Carol, not just programming was under question, but rather how the whole station was run, and whether it would be run in a kind of top-down hierarchical manner or whether it be run as a cooperative. And those kinds of discussions were going on all the time. And again, more bitter fights.
And there were behind-the-scenes agreements, too. I mean, Mary mentioned how KABU's landlord actually became involved in KABU internal politics. And part of the reason for that was because the landlord was told by the station manager and the then board president that KABU was going to be turning in this new direction, that it wasn't going to be quite so alternative in its personnel and its orientation in the future, and that it would be making this outreach to the classical music community and to more affluent members, maybe corporations that are in Portland, et cetera, and that they would be capable within 5 years of paying a much higher rent. So the landlord gave KABU a low rent for the first 5 years of the lease, with the expectation, first of all, renting us a marginal space that probably wasn't worth a whole lot more because it was totally unimproved, but also with the expectation that he would get higher rent from KABU afterwards because we would be more affluent at that point.
And that we would become good neighbors to all the lawyers and accountants who were in that building.
Anyway, there was a critical board election where there were five members to be replaced.
It'd
on
be
the
fall of 78.
Board. I think that's right, probably. Yeah, that's right. Fall of 78, there were five members, five slots open on the nine-member board, and there were 10 people running for the slots, and all 10 people had put in their board statements that they wished to dismiss the station manager. And so the outcome was pretty much assured even before the election occurred, and it was at that point that both the station manager, who we later found out by virtue of his admission to somebody else, that he had written a letter which the landlord signed indicating that KABU had broken his commitment, or our commitment, the station's commitment with him, and listing all these instances. A group of people, including a board member at the time, I think it was Dave now that I think about it, approached the landlord assured him that we would continue to be able to pay the rent and that KABU was not in violation of its lease, and also pointing out that there was nothing in the lease that said that we had to, you know, do certain things such as change our programming to all classical. And so we averted that crisis. However, 3 years later, when the end of the five-year lease came around, he increased KABU's rent from $500 a month or $400 a month, I think it was, to over 2,000 a month, and that's when KABU started shopping around and ultimately located this building and location. So
one thing I do remember about that time too, part of the way those of us in the staff were thinking was, what does growth mean in terms of programming? And I think that we managed. I think that we swam those waters fairly well, because KABU did start opening up to new areas. Well, areas of the community that never really had input in the year after that move. That's when John Talley's program started. That's when many, many people, young people from the African-American community started working at KABU, not just the historical George Page. Black gospel program. We started bilingual Spanish programs at that time. We had a problem with the transmitter. Gray and Pooh will remember this, that kept us literally off the air for something like 30 days, more or less. And January 77.
I heard that was a period of depression for
you. Oh, yeah. It was a major period of depression. That's sort of how a lot of us became friends. Michael O'Rourke, who I had only seen once or twice, I was program director at that point. Michael O'Rourke calls me up and says, I would like to talk to you and meet you and have lunch with you and hear what you have to say, hear your point of view. And I think we became friends from that very first lunch.
That's probably true. That was about the point at which I became a KABU board member, actually. I was appointed right during the middle of all this controversy, and I think I was appointed partly because there was a thought that at that time I was working as an engineer for Tektronix and traveling in from my suburban home to do my bluegrass show once a week. And that was pretty much my KABU involvement, the totality of my KABU involvement. And I came on the board of directors, I think, because I was seen as somebody who was outside of the KABU struggle, and perhaps even somebody who would lean towards the agenda that these people had for making KABU more of a money-raising operation.
But they misread you. And the other thing that should be said about this same period, in addition to what Carol just said about the programming, is that there was a major problem, and there were undemocratic forces at work. But when people really believe in something, they can triumph. And what happened was volunteers came together and spent hours and hours and hours strategizing and working and communicating to try to fix the problem. And I remember Dennis Brown, Sue Sargent, and I started one of the first volunteer organizations and decided that the way we had to change what was going on, the way we had to get it back on the right track, well, right, as far as I'm concerned, was to go to the board and talk to board members and try to have them see how we saw the station, what our vision of KABU was, as well as to encourage people to run for the board, and hence that slate of 10 people who all wanted to get rid of the station manager. And I'll add again, because it's such a wonderful story, that I was assigned to Michael O'Rourke to convince him the correctness of our position to use any means possible.
This is from the letter that I had mentioned earlier, which was supposedly penned by our landlord at the time, John Descamp. But in fact, we later learned, actually some of us suspected because of certain turns of phrase in this letter, but later learned it was written by KABU's station manager at the time. People from the radio station have written graffiti on the walls of the building, left wine and beer bottles in the stairwell and in other areas, left the first floor doors open on numerous occasions over the weekend and at night, and have been observed climbing up the dry standpipe as a means of gaining entrance to the radio station.
Okay. You want me to read this poem?
Yeah. However, I didn't write this poem, and I won't say who did. I mean, maybe she wants to take credit, maybe she doesn't.
Oh, but let's call it Anon.
Yeah, I'll call it Anon. Yeah.
And describe the period that this...
It's the period we were just talking about during 1977 and 1978, when there was a major power struggle going on at the board, and lots of decisions were being made behind closed doors, and the volunteers felt very disenfranchised. There is anger. There is hatred. The anger seethes and boils like magma beneath the surface, ready to boil over at the first sign of an opening. Just a niche or a crack. That is all we ask. Just one small chance to strike back and reclaim what was ours.
Oh, you lusting, slimy power mongers. You men who rot with cupidity. You have raped her, the love child of the ether god. With an ear for the clinking of gold and eyes on your wallets, you exile her most loyal followers. In secrecy and behind walls, you plan your next cruel action. The walls have ears. We have anger. Sums it up.
In those days, excuse me, in those days, one of the things that when I got on the air, I would always play Malvina Reynolds' song. The line was, they got the world in their pockets, but their pockets got a hole.
System has no soul. They've got the world in their pocket, but their pocket's got a hole. They've got the world in their pocket.
Malvina Reynolds, preceded by former KABU program director Carol Mazur, along with former volunteer and board member Michael O'Rourke, and former volunteer and staff member Mary Orr.
My name is Sarah Cook. I started out as a listener with KABU in the early 70s. About 1975, I met Carol Mazur at the Women's Place bookstore. Maybe it was 74, 75. And she told me about job and the company that I had worked for had gone bankrupt. So I was, you know, in that period of unemployment when so many people were. So I was looking for a job. And she told me about this position that was open, and I forgot now what it was. I think it was their public affairs and I applied for that, and I didn't get it, I think. And then about a year later or sometime later, it was in October of 1976, the station manager job came open, and I decided to apply for that. And I did, and I got it, which I couldn't believe. Was such a shock. Mm-hmm. And so I started in about October, I think, of 1976. And 6 months later, which would have been about February or March, I was fired by the board of directors in a public meeting with the Willamette Week and the Oregonian and I God knows who in the room. You know, a lot of people in the room shouting and screaming, and it was a really horrible experience.
Sarah, it's amazing.
I think I was the shortest-lived station manager, really, that KABU had. It was just a terrible rift, and I can remember, this wasn't the board meeting that I got fired, but I can remember one of the board meetings. We used to meet at the Mountain Moving Cafe, the old Mountain Moving Cafe, and I think it was Saturday morning or Sunday morning or whatever. And I can remember the staff, who was myself and Andy and Sue, and I can't remember beyond Andy and Sue, maybe Pooh. There were four or five of us. Maybe Carol. I think Carol was on the staff then. I'm sure she was. I don't know.
Yeah,
anyway.
She was program director, maybe.
Yeah, I think she was on the staff then, and we stood at the doorway in the Mountain Moving Cafe, and we had gotten there before the board, and we stood there singing, "We shall not be moved, we shall not be moved," as the board walked in. Now, what kind of that gives you an indication of the tenor between us. Interestingly enough, in the overall, the radical people won, even though it did move downtown. It threw all the upheavals and the boards and all the things that happened in the next two or three years. Some very reasonable radicals got on the board, I think, and really saved it. The thing that I remember that I think was so wonderful about the station in those days was the spontaneity, was the things that would happen just at the drop of a hat. Somebody would say, "Oh, so-and-so is happening. Do we have any music?" And we'd rattle around in the library there and find music and put it on. One particular time I remember, it was some anniversary in China. I don't know whether what revolution or what it was in China. And so we wanted to play music from China, you know, revolutionary music from China. And somebody mentioned, "Oh, the Frankels were back, and they had just been to China not too long ago." And so we got on the phone and called them. Did they bring any records back with them? And sure enough, they had. So somebody jumped in the car and drove up to in the Northwest to the Frankels. Really, it's true. Got their records, brought them back down, and we put them on the air. Mm-hmm. And so it was that kind of thing where there was so much spontaneity and there was so much energy, just incredible energy, and kind of everybody struggling to make it right. And, you know, everything would go wrong. The transmitter would go out or the mic wouldn't work. And you were just constantly
fighting with the equipment, you know, to keep everything going. And we had one little room that we did interviews in, and you'd get, you know, five, four, two, three, as many people as you could in there. And it, everybody would sweat, but, it, you know, there was just a wonderful feeling about it in retrospect.
My name is Andy Simon. I started in April of 74, and I left the staff in 77, I believe. I stayed on till just before KABU moved to Salmon Street downtown. And I was initially hired to broadcast Dawn Concert, 6 a.m. to 11 a.m. every morning, and well, Monday through Friday. And then when Bill Reinhart quit, I became a production manager, which basically meant I was assisting and also doing some recording of music and other kinds of arts events. When I left the staff, I continued doing classical music broadcasting as a volunteer, did an evening show for a while, and then I did some Dawn Concert for, well, for several years when we moved here to 8th Street, Saturday mornings. The atmosphere I could sum up in one word, and that was chaos. We were in a tiny little space, and yet it was impossible to walk from one end of our little studio space to the other as a staff member without being interrupted on the way by four or five people for four or five different things. It was total chaos, and we were cramped into this little space. We didn't have the equipment we used was really being held together by chewing gum and baling wire. It was really ramshackle. The transmitter would go off with alarming regularity. So it was very chaotic, but the people who worked here, it just became a real part of our lives. We worked minimum wage, but we worked 40, 50, 60 hours a week sometimes. It was also a labor of love for all of us. And it was a really exciting time.
That was Andy Simon. The next segment of the program features former staffers Sheila Rubin and Bridget Sarabi being interviewed by Marlena Smith and Jack at KABU's August 8th 30th anniversary party.
I started in 78 as a volunteer. In 79, I was the production coordinator, and then when Jonathan Potkin left, I became the program director. So I was like the world's youngest program director. I was 23, and I was a woman, and I would go to these radio conferences, these NPR radio conferences halfway across the country, and all these men would sit around in their suits, and I'd be there in my blue jeans, and they'd go, "You're a program director?" And because, you know, I looked like a kid, and I was female, and I was 23, and it was an amazing thing, and I never realized how amazing that was.
Well, speaking of kids, I do believe that Bridget Sarabi has you beat just a little bit. I believe that she was a development director when you were 17?
18. I started working with Mary in the office and sorting transistors for the engineering department, and I was a work-study student, and then became development director, and then came back at 23 as station manager.
Yeah. I'd sort of like to know from you women, this is Marlena, what about this station made sense to you or attracted you? Because this had to have been so distinct from anything that any of you grew up with. Like, Bridget, where did you grow up?
I grew up by Mount Hood.
Okay, and so this was pretty new to you.
Well, in a way, but I grew up around a lot of hippies, and so I felt right at home. And the music was great. I mean, it was great to go from Gregorian chant to Tibetan music to George Page interviewing someone in prison. It was wonderful.
Sheila, how about you?
Well, I had been studying local cable origination in college in Southern Illinois University, and I was fascinated with the idea of community broadcasting, or it wasn't broadcasting, community, communications through media. And I quit school because I didn't like all the public TV, you know, commercial TV stuff. So I thought I was going to go cable. And when I found KABU, which was radio, I thought, this is what I really want. It's the community is involved. I can help people learn how to use microphones. I can help people get on the air. I can get different communities involved here. It was like a dream come true.
You've been listening to a special program. Tune in, turn on, and remember, honoring KABU's 45th anniversary year, this year, 2013. Tonight, we've heard the voices of some of the early volunteers and staff with KABU Community Radio, which began in 1968 in the city of Portland as a listener-supported, community-based station. The recordings you just heard were digitized from reel-to-reel tape. There are thousands of reels currently in KABU's back storage room, just waiting to be digitized. You can help with this project by donating online to support KABU. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today in the upper right corner.
Tune in Tuesday nights from 8 to 10 p.m. for The Melting Pot, featuring DJs, producers, and electronic artists from around the globe. Win tickets and stay up on events each and every Tuesday from 8 to 10 p.m. on The Melting Pot, right here at 90.7 FM KBOO.
This is KBOO. You are listening to an edition of The Melting Pot. We do it every Tuesday from 8 to 10. That's every Tuesday from 8 to 10. Today we're starting a little bit early. We're going to kick it off an hour early for the people that are at the Silent Dance Party. If you don't know about it, it's over at Director's Park this week. We only have a couple of them left, so we figured that we'd switch up the locations a little bit on you. So there is a lot of people that have already RSVP'd to the event, so there's probably some folks with their headphones on already. I'm not going to keep talking for too long, but I did want to let you know you can tune in at 90.7 in Portland, 91.9 FM in Hood River or The Gorge, 104.3 FM in Philomath and Corvallis, and online at kboo.fm/listen. There's a few other programs that you can listen to us on as well, SoundTap and TuneIn, in case you have any issues with the web. But I think that we are on board and things are running pretty smooth for the last couple days or last day or so. So let's get into the show. I got a bunch of great music for you. We're going to start it off kind of slow, build it up, maybe bring it down for you a little bit in the middle, and then bring it back up for you.